George Monbiot is a weekly columnist for The Guardian and the author of Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. He joins Paul Jay to discuss the book in the Real News studio.
What do you think the world will look like in 2050?
You can't be definitive about it because the current path could go in various different directions. There's no fixed path that we're on. But there is a high chance that if we don't restrain climate change to the sort of level that I'm talking about, we will see a net global drying, a significant drying trend across the world as a whole. Not everywhere, some wet places will become wetter still. This means, first off, that in many parts, particularly in Africa, we'll see crop failures. If those crop failures are sufficiently widespread, we could see the possibility of a global food deficit. You must remember that at the same time, human populations will continue to rise. And it is beyond my powers of description to tell you what a world of 9 billion people in net food deficit would look like. It makes all previous human crises, wars, acts of genocide, famines, plagues, look like sideshows at the circus of human suffering. We haven't been there. We've never been at a point quite like that before.
Why do carbon emissions cause global warming? Just simple.
Sure. Over the last many hundreds of millions of years, biological matter has accumulated as plants have grown and absorbed carbon dioxide, turned it into the organic molecules which make those plants up, and then died and been covered with sediments and have rotted in oxygen-free environments. That carbon has been accumulated. And it's been accumulated in the form of coal and oil and natural gas. As we extract that, we are turning many millions of years' worth of accumulation into a sudden pulse of carbon dioxide. If we released it at the same speed at which those plants absorbed it, there wouldn't be a problem. But it's because we are burning it very, very quickly. We're releasing every year millions of years' worth of biological accumulation. And we are thereby enhancing the world's natural greenhouse effect so that more and more solar radiation is trapped within the atmosphere. The key is to prevent that from going past that certain point, that tipping point, that threshold, which scientists now identify as being roughly at 2 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures.
We're already on the way to 2 degrees. Where are we now in relationship to that 2 degrees?
Right, well, we're at about 0.7 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures. We're almost certainly headed to 1.3, 1.4 degrees, even if we were to stop right now because of the carbon dioxide we've already produced. Bringing it down, bringing our emissions down so that we don't go beyond that 2 degree point is the whole thrust of this book, is how we do that. We need a worldwide cut of 60% by 2030, which translates, if those emissions are to be spread evenly, into a cut of 90% in the rich nations. And that derives from figures which are now broadly accepted across the scientific community.
The science seems so clear. The situation is urgent. But certainly most people don't feel it. People are mildly aware of it. I know in the U.S., polls seem to say 30-35% of people will answer that it's urgent. It's a little higher in other countries. If it was really so high, I think you would see far more political pressure on governments to be doing something about it. Yes. So even if people can answer a survey, yes, it's urgent, they go about their life. Why aren't people feeling this urgency?
Because they know in their heart of hearts this, they understand this awful paradox of climate change, which is that most of the nations which are rich are in the temperate parts of the world. The temperate parts of the world, which are largely responsible for the problem, are the ones which are going to get hit last and least by climate change. If we lived in tropical countries, if we were in the tropics, we would have acted on this by now.
There's a recent report the British government commissioned called the Stern Review, and it said as follows, The scientific evidence is now overwhelming. Climate change presents very serious global risks, and it demands an urgent global response. How significant is this report?
The significance is as follows, that those who have sought to deny that we need to take action on climate change, many of whom have been sponsored by the fossil fuel industry to do that, started off by saying climate change isn't happening. It's all a myth. It's all a conspiracy dreamt up by the UN and a cabal of left-wing, anti-business, anti-American environmentalists. Then, without ever admitting that they'd got it wrong, they smoothly moved over to saying, OK, climate change is happening, but it's a good thing, not a bad thing. We'll be able to grow wine in Scotland, have Mediterranean holidays in Toronto. And then, without ever admitting that they got that bit wrong, they moved on to saying, OK, climate change is happening, and it's a bad thing, not a good thing. But it would cost far too much to do anything about it. It would cost more to try to prevent than it would cost to adapt to. And what Stern has done in his review is to show the opposite, that it would cost far more to try to live with climate change than to try to prevent runaway climate change from taking place. My concern with Stern's report is as following, that this isn't an economic issue, this is a moral issue. Even if the economic case said it doesn't make sense to be spending money on climate change because it would cost less to try to live with the effects, the costs of climate change, the real costs, are not measured in dollars and pounds. The real costs are measured in lives, in human lives, and in ecosystems. Immeasurable.
Stern says there's still time, and he makes recommendations. Is Stern recommendations enough?
No. What's very interesting about the Stern report is that, like an awful lot of British government reports, there's a lot of good sense in the middle, sandwiched with bullshit at top and bottom. If you go to the middle of the report, you will see that he says the government's targets in the United Kingdom are woefully inadequate and we need to go much, much further. He's even calling for deeper cuts than the ones that I'm calling for. He's calling for a 7% annual cut, which is even beyond my 90% by 2030. But that doesn't appear in the summary and conclusions at all. It's simply not there. In the summary, he endorses the government's proposed cut of 60% by 2050, which is an entirely different kettle of fish.
This goes with something you mentioned in your book, that some of the people that really know the science compromise the science because for what they think is politically achievable.
There's a very good example of this, which is in the person of the government's chief scientist in the United Kingdom, who's been a brave man in some ways. He stood up to the Bush administration. He wrote a very strong article in Science saying that the Bush administration's position on climate change was a disgrace. And he took a lot of flack for that. But then he stood up at a conference that I attended and said, I am aiming for stabilizing carbon concentrations in the atmosphere at 550 parts per million. Now, someone in the audience who knows a lot about this stood up and said, but that's ridiculous, because at 550 parts per million, we've only got a 10% chance of avoiding 2 degrees of climate change. And Sir David King said, sure, but it would be politically unrealistic to call for anything lower. Whereupon this man says, but your job is not to represent political reality, your job is to represent scientific reality. You're not a spin doctor, you're a scientist, you're the chief scientist. You've got to say what the science says. And he says, but if I said that, no one would take me seriously. Whereupon this man says, I have ceased to take you seriously.
I accuse you of the same.
Mm-hmm.
If it is as serious as you say, and I believe it is, then how can we do less than declare warlike conditions? How can we do less than have the kind of government intervention that a World War II required and actually hit these targets?
We can't. We have to do that. Where's the controversy? I mean, I completely agree with that as the analysis. We need to go onto an emergency planning footing. And it can be done. We are asking people for far less than they were asked for at the outbreak of the Second World War. When the Second World War began, people were asked to sacrifice their lives. We're asking people to sacrifice their holidays in Thailand. It's not exactly comparable. And on the other side, I mean, the changes we have to make in our lives are, by comparison to the changes that will be made in other people's lives, inconsequential. Yeah, we'll have to cut back on the amount we drive and the amount we fly, and we'll have to insulate our houses better, and we'll have to buy energy-efficient light bulbs, etc., etc., etc. Sure, there'll be some disruptive changes. But think about the disruptive changes of the people in Africa. Tens of millions of people who will be without food, who will be without homes. They simply do not compare. The sacrifice which we are being asked to make is tiny by comparison to the sacrifice which they will have to make if we don't act.
But I'm hit after reading your book. Are those relatively small sacrifices, as you describe, really enough? And in some ways, I would rather personally be told, yeah, it's a wartime footing. Yeah, you may have to make big sacrifices, and get ready.
You're in a very small minority. Most people want just the opposite. They want things to be as smooth and as painless as possible. And I have to make this politically feasible. And by political feasibility, I mean making it as painless as possible. So we just have to sugar the pill. Now, the carbon rationing system is a way of making it fair. It's also a way of making it politically plausible, because if people see that everybody is subject to the same constraints, then they're more likely to be able to feel they can participate. It's also a way of generating tremendous enthusiasm for low-carbon technologies, because if you want to keep using a large amount of energy to keep the lights on and to keep the heating on and all the rest of it, you're going to want that energy to be as low-carbon as possible so that you can continue to use it and stay within your carbon ration.
How do we deal with the elephant in the room of this whole debate? If we can't get this conversation going in the U.S.,
yes.
Or should I put it more positively, how do we get this conversation going?
No, you're quite right. I mean, at the moment, if the U.S. is sitting over there, we're all going like this. Oh, look, Iceland's doing well. Sweden, yeah, look good what's happening in Sweden. All 7 million people in Sweden are heading in the right direction. And yes, of course, we are ignoring it because it's almost too terrifying.
I know you say in your book, let's not blame China, but if the predictions are correct, then in a matter of 4 years, China will be the number one producer of carbon emissions.
Sure, but not per capita, not by a very long way. And at the
moment, not per capita, but the problem isn't per capita. The problem is just how much is getting churned out.
Well, sure, but the solution is per capita. For us to turn to the Chinese and to point the finger at them and say they are the problem, we have to become hypocrites on a scale which is almost unprecedented. I mean, the Chinese at the moment, per capita, produce 2.7 tons of carbon dioxide per year. The Canadians produce 19, and the Americans 20. The Chinese individually are not the problem. Collectively, they will become the problem.
And collectively, the Americans are certainly now the problem.
Yes.
And
let me tell you, the Chinese are not going to move on this unless we show that we're moving. At the moment, every nation is using every other as its excuse for not taking the necessary action.
I mean, we know that still 80% of people get their news and information from television. Yeah. And what role does American TV play in this?
It plays a critical role. I mean, TV is the gatekeeper of public consciousness. And it's been a very effective gatekeeper, particularly in the United States. It's not just that it's biased against this particular idea, it is biased against ideas. It is biased against understanding.
There's direct censorship, there's intervention, there's pressure on the media. How much do you blame this in terms of people, Americans, not feeling this sense of urgency?
Oh, I blame the media for people not feeling the sense of urgency rather than the people not feeling the sense of urgency for the media. The problem begins with the media, and the media is censored as heavily as the media was in the Soviet Union. That sounds like an extreme statement. It's not censored by the state, or very little by the state, hardly at all. It is censored by money. And listen, the big corporations, the big media corporations, have one thing in common. They are run by multimillionaires. And multimillionaires have one thing in common. They want a better world for multimillionaires. By and large, a better world for multimillionaires is a worse world for the rest of us. So they have to persuade us that a better world for them is a better world for us, and they do so by lying. And the lies primarily are lies of omission. They cut out anything which is inconvenient to the worldview that they are trying to create.
I think that's too general. It's easy. But I think it's more the kind of self-censorship that goes in the heads of journalists. It's partly what's good for my career and what isn't.
Sure.
And that's situated in the environment you're talking about.
Yeah, but precisely, I'm not saying that the proprietor comes along and says, thou shalt take the following line. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
Journalists, by and large, are intelligent people. They know where their interests lie. They know that if they take a particular line, they get on in their work, and if they don't, they don't get on.
And in terms of ordinary journalists and others working in big media organizations, I don't think even today people get, like, there's been such an organized campaign to throw pressure on the fact whether human activity even causes global warming, never mind even getting to the debate of how urgent it is.
Do you have a science degree?
No.
I'm not singling you out. I went to a meeting of senior television journalists about a year ago, 150 of us there. And the chairman of the meeting says, how many people here got a science degree? And three of us put our hands up. This is a big part of the problem, that the people who run the media generally have a humanities background. And they have very little idea, not of what science says, because none of us can be expected to have a broad idea of what science says. It's moving, shifting all the time. It's very, very complex. But of what science is. And journalists have enormous trouble distinguishing between those reputable scientists like James Hansen, who you mentioned, and these Exxon-sponsored mountebanks who are basically just working for a public relations agency in coming up with a whole load of totally meaningless figures without any research behind them, any publications in peer-reviewed scientific journals saying it's not happening. And journalists have been bamboozled by this because of their lack of expertise in knowing what science is.
Talk about the 8 or 9 practical proposals you make in the book.
Okay, so what I've done is to look at every major economic sector and to say within that sector, how are we going to achieve that 90% cut? So in housing, for example, two fundamental approaches. The first is a massive investment in energy efficiency, the sort of thing that the German government is doing at the moment. Every year, it's taking 5% of the homes built before 1978 and turning them into incredibly energy efficient homes.
So who pays for that?
The German government. So this is a government sponsored.
So this is also an issue of taxation, then?
It's an issue of either new taxation or the redeployment of resources. So in the UK, for example, we're currently on the verge of committing to spending 76 billion pounds, 150 billion Canadian dollars, on a new nuclear missile system. No one knows why we need a new nuclear missile system. That has not been explained to us. If we spent that money instead on a new energy system, problem solved. And anyone can see why that money needs to be spent in a new energy system. But somehow the money is always available for terminating life and never available for preserving life. This is the central mystery of the modern state.
And the nuclear?
I don't believe anymore that we're going to see a new Chernobyl. I really don't. I don't think that's going to happen with a new generation of nuclear power stations. And I think that many of the arguments against nuclear no longer apply. But among the other things I'd like to see in the world is the eventual end of nuclear weapons. Like almost everyone would like to see a world without nuclear weapons. Having seen what's happened since the Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in 1968, in which every nation which has become or has sought to become a nuclear power, to acquire nuclear weapons, has done so by diverting materials from their civil nuclear program. I see that a world without nuclear weapons is impossible unless you have a world without nuclear power. That's why I come out against nuclear. Yes, this system of new electricity generation and, more importantly, new heat generation, because we use far more heat in our homes than electricity. And that means a big investment in making use of biomass. In Canada, you've got quite a lot. But it also means, and this is a slightly wacky idea, a hydrogen pipeline network, piping hydrogen into people's homes to burn in their furnaces. It's as safe as natural gas, strangely. But it can be produced with very, very few carbon emissions. Then in transport, a revolution in surface transport and the way that we get around. For a start, I'd like to see a lot of our private car use replaced by a far swifter, more efficient, more sensible public transport network. And that would revolve, here's the bad news, around the bus. Now, we hate buses. Buses are dismal and humiliating ways of getting around and very slow and cumbersome. But that's because the system is crazy. The system doesn't work. The bus stations are in the city centres. It's crazy. It's a hangover from the days in which they were pulled by horses and were probably faster. The second is that the buses don't have dedicated lanes on the highways. If you close down the city centre bus stations, move them out to the junctions of the highways, extend your urban public transport networks out to meet them, you revitalise those urban public transport networks because they serve the suburbs much more regularly than before, and you ensure that the buses don't have to go in and out of the cities, therefore slowing themselves down. They have priority at the intersections, and they are faster than the private car, while only producing 10% of the carbon emissions per passenger kilometre.
Would you ban the oil-burning combustion engine?
I could do that only if we have another system with which to replace it, and I think that such a system might be available. It is as follows. We know that the electric car works, but we know that the problem with the electric car is its limited range, that after 100 or 200 miles, the battery runs down, and then you have to plug it in and wait for hours before it recharges. What if you don't own the battery? What if you lease that battery from a network of filling stations? And as it begins to run down, you pull into the filling station, you open up the bonnet, crane comes over, lifts out the old battery, lifts in a new one, and you're off. No more time than it takes to fill up your tank with gasoline.
It's a great idea, and it would involve an enormous political battle with the oil industry.
Yes. Yes.
How does that battle, how is it waged and how is it won?
That battle comes down to us. This really is a matter of the people versus the oil companies. There's a lot more of us than there are of them, though they've got a great deal of power, particularly over the political process. But we have to turn carbon emissions into the overriding political issue. We have to put this right at the top of the political agenda and keep it there, because otherwise, we have on our consciences the future probable deaths of hundreds of millions of people.